At 8 o'clock, we start class. And a brief review, we were talking about voltammetry last time. And when we talk about voltammetry, I mentioned before, isn't it all voltammetry? Well, it's all electrochemistry in an electrolytic type of cell. And so we're stirring in some cases, we're not stirring in other cases, but in all cases we're applying a voltage, we're applying power to the system to cause an oxidation or reduction reaction to occur. That is different than the potentiometric systems where we have a galvanic cell and the system spontaneously produces a potential which we measure and relate to concentration. Here, we apply a potential, cause oxidation and reduction to occur, and measure the current, usually. That's the case in voltammetry. The applied waveform is a potential versus time waveform, and in typical voltammetry, it's just linear, sometimes referred to as linear sweep voltammetry. And then we measure, what we measure is the current, I, versus E, the potential. The system is stirred, we'll see in a minute. So I set it all up for you, stationary electrode, but it's stirred. And so we do have convective mass transport. Measure current versus time, vary potential linearly with time. So that's this plot, and that's this plot. And we get ox going to red in a reduction mode. They're both soluble species, reversible reaction. That just means it's well behaved. And what do we get? Well, we get a curve that looks like this, okay, this sort of wave. Okay, it is a wave. And the idea behind this is we have two sort of domains. The Nernstein-controlled domain. Nernst equation says I got to have a certain potential in order for the reaction to occur. This is defined for me using E0 and the Nernst equation. And it's not to say, I don't mean this to be a sharp dividing line here, really. That's not the case. In reality, it's sort of a region where you go from predominantly Nernstein controlled, because what's happening here? Well, nothing. Nothing's happening here because the Nernst equation says you haven't reached a sufficient potential. There's not there's a certain amount of free energy required. E can be related to delta G, and so we don't have enough energy there to cause the reaction to occur. As I move along the E axis, okay, and I get to more and more reducing potentials, I ultimately reach a region where I can cause the reduction to occur. The minute the reduction begins to occur, we do have mass transport issues, we'll say. So the minute you start using up material at the surface of the electrode, things are going to diffuse to replace that material that's been used up. So we sort of transition into a region where it's mass transport controlled. Out here it's purely mass transport controlled. Down here it's purely Nernstein controlled. In between, okay, at the region in the middle, it's sort of a little of each, probably. Okay, but we went through that for voltammetry with a stirred solution. We said we have this equation. Not the control equation. The control equation was for diffusion controlled systems. This is for stirred systems. We have that little delta for the Nernst diffusion layer. And then, of course, we have the Nernst equation down in this region. Okay. Quantitative information is given by the limiting current. Okay, and it's defined up here for you. And let's see. We have another graph, another picture of the same thing. Limiting current, this is a little more straight up wave. We talked about the limiting current as the quantitative piece of information. So I'm measuring IL. I'm measuring this height of this wave off of the baseline, and that tells me how much stuff I have. I get the amount of stuff because I get that current because of the material being converted from ox to red, from an oxidized form to a red form, to a reduced form. And so that's how I tell how much I have. I compare that with standards, whatever, and I got to make a calibration curve or something. I'll talk about calibration. Probably won't get to it today, but beginning of next class. And Then I have qualitative information from the E1/2. Like an E0, analogous to the E0, related to the E0, the wave has an inflection point or has a point of steepest slope or the midpoint of the wave, halfway to the limiting current, tells me what it is that I'm reducing. And again, it matters what reference electrode I'm using because that affects the potential. And I can look these things. It matters what's in the solution. It matters what the salts are, what the pH maybe is, or things like that. Okay, I talked about the wave and the capacitive current that builds as you scan. Okay, as you vary E, you're building, you're charging the electrodes. So you do have a baseline or a background of capacitive current. And we'll talk a little bit today about it being called residual current, maybe. Another name for basically the same thing. But that baseline is there in this previous slide. This doesn't have any of that. Why not? Well, if the concentration is really high and your sensitivity, therefore, is low, because you don't need high sensitivity to measure high concentration, so you back off on your sensitivity, you don't see the capacitive current. Capacitive current is small, usually, and therefore you get a nice flat baseline and a nice straight-up curve like this. If I'm measuring low concentrations, if I'm measuring trace levels of some species, I have to increase my concentration. That means that my capacitive current becomes expanded or amplified, and so I start to see that sloped baseline. The greater sensitivity that I need, the greater this slope begins to look because of that amplification factor that I am putting into the system by increasing the sensitivity. All that means is the Faradaic portion is probably getting smaller. I have to increase the sensitivity to see smaller and smaller currents. So capacitive current was introduced as well as the limiting current. What else? I mentioned the E1/2 here, and this, let's see, I is proportional to, okay. IL, okay, so red is maximum. Yeah, so we just went through some of these things. I gave you the equation that relates the potential and the E1/2 to the limiting current, or the current at any place along the I is anywhere along the curve. IL, of course, is the limiting current. We talked a little bit about how reversibility affects the situation. Remember that I said I can have degrees of reversibility. It's not just reversible or irreversible, well-behaved or not well-behaved, fast kinetics or not so fast kinetics. That's not the case. There's ranges or degrees of reversibility because there's different rate constants for the electrode kinetics. So if I have good, fast, well-behaved kinetics, then I get a nice, normal-looking wave, and that's a reversible case. I start to get slow kinetics, and the wave becomes drawn out. And the slower they are, the more it's drawn out. Now, if I scan faster, my kinetics, the reaction that's occurring at the electrode surface, has more trouble keeping up with the reaction. Keeping up with the scan rate. The reaction has trouble keeping up with the scan rate. If I scan really fast across my potential range, then the reaction may not be able to keep up. So the reversibility, the degree of reversibility, actually has two components. It has the component of how fast are the kinetics intrinsic to the system, and what's the time frame or time scale of my measurement that I'm doing, the measurement system. If I'm scanning really, really fast, I may get nothing. Right? If I zip across this potential range, I may see nothing because the reaction is slow enough that it cannot respond to the rapid potential scan that I'm doing. I take the same experiment, turn around, and scan really, really slow. Then I've got plenty of time for the reaction to occur and the response to develop, the current response to develop as I slowly scan across my potential range. So it matters how time scale of the measurement, how fast I'm scanning versus the kinetics. Those two factors are important. double waves for two component systems, and then I've got sort of a summary here. We often use a platinum or carbon electrode because it's voltammetry. Now we're going to talk about polarography in a minute with a mercury electrode, but that's a different beast. Similar experiment in terms of the electrochemistry, but a little bit of a different beast is how you put the experiment together. So here, in classic voltammetry, I might use a platinum or carbon, maybe a gold electrode. If I want to stir, I'm better off rotating the electrode. Okay, rotating the electrode is maybe a means of stirring. Linear scan voltammetry can be used for quantitative analysis, limiting current versus concentration. Can measure all sorts of metal ions and organic functional groups, although it's used probably more for metal ions, and that's certainly my experience. Fairly sensitive. There's better, more sensitive techniques. We're going to build to those in the next few classes. Convective mass transport and so forth. The wave is considered a drawback. Okay, the fact that we have a wave rather than a peak is considered to be a drawback, and for the reasons mentioned here and probably some others. Small wave on top of a big wave. Okay, if this signal here is huge, it's going to be difficult for me to see that really small second wave. Okay. All right. Then I went into unstirred voltammetry, and I said it's the exact same experiment with one minor detail. I switched off my stirring mechanism, whether that's a stirring bar or a rotating electrode. I just turn it off. That's it. Do the exact same experiment. I get a different result. Okay, it now becomes a diffusion-controlled system. All other factors in my experiment that I set up for you are the same. Instead of getting a wave, we get a peak. Okay, we get this sort of lopsided-looking peak. And it's lopsided because, again, Nernstein-controlled on the left-hand side, diffusion-controlled on the right-hand side. So two different things are going on. We don't get perfect symmetry. It's not a Gaussian or Lorentzian or whatever kind of peak you want. It's not symmetrical. And it's not symmetrical because of the reason that we have two different processes controlling what goes on. And so we talked about that. And again, it's largely Nernstein controlled. There's sort of a gray area in the middle where it's a little of both. It's Nernstein-controlled and diffusion-controlled from the Cottrell equation. Remember that if it's a peak, we have an I sub P, a current, a peak current. If it's a peak, we have a peak potential. If it's a wave, it's a half-wave potential and a limiting current. Okay, so just different names, but they are different things because it's a different beast that we're dealing with. Okay, I probably gave you these equations. The peak current in voltammetry is related to several things that we know about, but this equation is kind of ugly because it has, you know, three halves and one half power and so forth. But that's okay. It's RT and F. They happen to be inverted here in our square roots and so forth, cube roots. There's a constant. There's electrode area, diffusion coefficient, the concentration, and then the only parameter that we really haven't seen before is this one, which is the scan rate. Okay, new term, scan rate. How fast are we scanning? It turns out that if I scan fast, I get a larger peak. I get a bigger curve. If you stop and think about it, it does make a little bit of sense because the faster scan gets me from a region of no reaction, the Nernstein-controlled region where there's no reaction going on. The E is not sufficient to cause the reaction to occur. And then I rapidly get to a region where there is full reduction of the species in the system. And so I'm able to get a bigger peak. The current rises to its maximum value quickly. All the material is right near the electrode, or some material is right near the electrode, to rapidly react. And so I get a big current because of that. All right. So the peak current is proportional to the scan rate, not directly proportional to the 1/2 power. Okay, what else do we have here? Relationship between peak potential and the E1/2, and then previously I related the E1/2 to the E0. So they're all related. Okay, they're very close to one another, but not the same. They're not the same thing. What else? Two components, one wave after the other. I just stuck two waves together. I mentioned here, difficult to determine the baseline at times because you do have to come up with, you do have to determine, you know, where's the baseline in the system that I'm measuring my peak current from. So that can be a little bit tricky. Okay, I then at the end of class last time, I think I gave you some kind of a segue into what was referred to as cyclic voltammetry. The idea that we did this experiment over here. We did this part of the experiment. We scanned in a linear fashion, scanned the potential versus time, okay, and we said, okay, we're changing that potential, and we're scanning across some range, and our system is going to react. That experiment can then be reversed. I've converted ox to red. That might even be... I converted ox to red. Okay, it's, you know, plus an electron, or however, n electrons, however many electrons. And then I can turn around and scan in the other direction. Okay, I can scan back to the original potential that I started. And what happens there is, any of the reduced species that's in the vicinity of the electrode will be oxidized to whatever the oxidized form of that species is. So I can see a reducing wave in the forward scan and an oxidizing wave in the reverse scan. And of course I can repeat that process. I can cycle the potential in the system, ox to red, red to ox. Now, there's a couple of issues here if you start thinking about it. There's the issue of mass transport. If I'm converting ox to red and mass transport is occurring, red is being produced and is diffusing away, and ox is diffusing in, and then I turn around and go in the other direction, and I begin to oxidize the red that was produced, but it's diffused away a little bit. So I may not get all of it to be oxidized in my reverse scan, but I can get some of it. And if I'm quick about it, I may be able to get all of it. All right. So we're moving into the realm of cyclic voltammetry, and I'll talk more in detail about that. I did want to put this plot up, and I did, I guess, last class. And this is the idea that, by convention, electrochemists have decided, there we go, that if I'm plotting things, so we can all plot things the same way, if I'm doing a reduction, I'm going to operate in this realm up here. In other words, I'm plotting current versus potential. It's cathodic current and cathodic potential because I'm doing a reduction, and reduction takes place at the cathode. And I'm going to plot it in this quadrant of a set of axes. Okay, set of axes, and I'm going to plot in the upper right-hand corner of it, in other words, positive, the positive region from a mathematical point of view, set of axes, it's positive numbers. Now, the potentials might be negative. They may span the range across zero, and you may have negative potentials because typically more negative potentials are reducing potentials, but the point is that if I'm doing a reduction and I'm generating a cathodic current, I'm going to be plotting things up in here. If I'm doing the oxidation, I'm going to plot it over here. Now that has some relevance to my previous slide. Let's see, I got to skip back here. It has some relevance to this, because then if I'm doing reduction here in my forward scan, I'm doing oxidation here. So if I plot that, if I'm going to plot that on a set of axes, okay, if I'm going to plot that on a set of current I versus E axes, I'm going to be dealing with the reduction up here. When I go to the oxidation, I said I drew it in my slide down in this region, but the actual values of E are important, and so I'm going to end up with my reduction over here. Excuse me, my oxidation. Reduction's up here, oxidation's down here. So I bring that up because that's an important issue in electrochemistry, so you understand what it is that you're seeing. Now, does everybody follow this convention rigorously? No. As a matter of fact, what's going on here? Okay, thank you. It's not always followed, and I'll give you one example later in a couple of classes of a situation where electrochemists don't follow this convention, but for the most part they do. And certainly with cyclic voltammetry, it is followed. All right, let me mention what I already gave you my rendition of what the cyclic voltammogram would look like. Here's one that I pulled off the internet to show you somebody's data, and I don't have any idea what it's all about, what experiment they were doing. But it does show you that, okay, we've got some potentials plotted here on the x-axis. It's in millivolts, so rather than volts, but we could make it volts. You know, we could put little decimal points in here. And so they're scanning from a positive 100 up to a negative value, okay, negative 600. Positive 100 and negative 600, and their current values are on the y-axis, and they go along and they see a reduction occurring. Okay, they're going to more and more negative potentials, and they see a reduction occurring, and that is the peak potential, and they have a C there for cathodic process. So EPC is the potential for the cathodic process. Okay, so that would be taken off the potential axis, or all the way down here. And then there is some current value, which we would get, you know, over here. Okay, so this would be IP, okay, peak current. So they scan along, and they get their wave, okay, as we talked about, and it's a little bit lopsided, you know, Nernstein versus diffusion controlled. And then they turn around and scan in the opposite direction. So if we looked at E versus time, you know, it would be this point represents this point, okay, in the potential axis. Then I scan back in the other direction, and we get a, you know, baseline, just like we would see over here, we have over here. And then all of a sudden we see the current rise. Now it's rising. It's going down. I'm saying it's rising because it's anodic. It's an anodic process. And so we're oxidizing the species, and then we get a peak, and then it's just the upside-down version of what we saw above. Nernstein controlled here, diffusion controlled over here. Okay, and a little of both in between. So we've got all of that going on here. So we get this nice, fairly symmetrical looking system. You get a nice symmetrical looking system if you scan at reasonably fast scan rates. Well, maybe 100 millivolts every minute, okay? And so this whole process might take, you know, 6-7 minutes. So diffusion doesn't have a chance to get the reduced species that's created up here, doesn't diffuse too far away. And then it's able to be reduced in the it is reduced in the forward scan. It's able to be oxidized in the reverse scan, and so we get a pretty much symmetrical looking system. Okay, now let's tear it apart. That's what the purpose of this plot is, to tear apart the cyclic voltammogram and tell you what's going on at every little step along the way. All right, so that's what we're doing. Convention for plotting current and potential. Okay, so we already went through that. Cathodic currents, anodic currents are down here, and then just potentials along the x-axis. So I start out at A. That's a good place to start. And what's happening? Not a whole lot. All right, we do have potential being applied. Okay, so E versus time is being applied to the electrochemical cell, and it's nice linear ramp at some slope of potential versus time, some scan rate. And so as I do that, I'm not getting any, I'm at a potential where there's not really any reduction occurring. This isn't occurring yet. But I do see a slope in the line. I do see an increase because capacitive current. Okay, so there's a baseline. If there's no aux in the system, I would see a baseline that would just rise up because of capacitive current constantly building up in the system. Right? That's what's happening at A. At B, I begin to see some curvature. Okay, it's not just a slope line due to capacitive current, but I'm seeing an upward curvature due to the reduction of aux to red according to the Nernst equation. So at point B, or in the region around B, I'm beginning to see the actual electrochemistry occur, the actual reduction of the oxidized form of whatever the stuff is. I move along the curve until I reach my peak current, and a peak potential, peak current, both occur here. This is peak potential down here. This is peak current off of this axis, okay? And so we get up to the point C. Now that's sort of my transition where, since it's unstirred, diffusion-controlled system, I have reached the potential at which all of the material is being all of the material is being reduced, and according to the Nernst equation, this is going on, but I can no longer sustain that current. I reach the current, and immediately I can't sustain it because I'm waiting for material to diffuse from the bulk solution to the electrode surface. So that's what's going on here at C. Current drops off. Maybe I should have put a letter here. I should have put D here, E here. Anyway, current drops off. What's going on in this region? Okay, it's depleted. It's Cottrell equation, behavior. Current's dropping off because of the diffusion controlled process is now taken over. What about Nernst? He doesn't matter anymore. Nernst is no longer important. Why? Because we are at a sufficient potential for all of the material, whatever it is, aux, to be converted to red. Okay, at all potentials above this potential, it will continue to be converted to red. All right? So Nernst is no longer important. He was important in this region because there was that whole right-hand side of the equation governing what was happening, what the concentrations were and how that influences the E0 to give you the appropriate E. So now we're in the Cottrell region, and the current drops off down to point D. Okay, down to point D. Then, in my experiment, I'm doing cyclic voltammetry. So I change the direction of my scan, and I start scanning in the opposite direction. There's a little bit of a jump here. Okay, what's happening? The capacitive current is switching its sign, so to speak. I was causing, I had a negative potential on my electrode, and I'm causing positive ions to flow to the electrode and build up that capacitive current that I talked about, sort of baseline. Okay. Now I switch that, and I'm going in the opposite direction, and so there's an immediate drop in the current that I see, and I start to see my capacitive current go in the other direction. Okay, its sign changes. And so, I'm going to build capacitive current. Now, if there was nothing in there, I'd still be building capacitive current. Okay, I'd still be, if there was no aux or red in the system, I would still have a sloped scan because of capacitive current, because there are ions in there that are migrating around and causing charging current or capacitive current. So I switch switch the direction of my scan, and from point E to point F, probably not too much is happening. It's a Nernstein-controlled region in the opposite direction. There is not sufficient potential, or there is still sufficient potential to cause OX to be converted to red, but I'm scanning in the opposite direction. By the time I get to F, or F to G, this region, I am now actually converting red to OX. I go all the way up to a maximum value. Okay, my peak current in the anodic direction. So we saw it before as IPA. Okay, peak current in the anodic direction. So I keep moving along until I get to that region. Now this region corresponds with this region, right? They're both Nernstein. If you were wondering, well, why isn't this peak and this peak? Why don't they coincide? Well, because Nernst says it's this region of the curve where the Nernst equation applies. So, but in an opposite direction, right? An opposite manner. So I'm building up until I get to the maximum anodic current, and then I begin to drop off again, diffusion controlled, but in the opposite direction, red going to OX. And then at the end, HIJ, I reverse my scan again. E versus time, scan up, scan down, scan up again. And I start over with my cyclic voltammogram. All right? Does that make some sense? Now, I've stretched all this out to give you a blow-by-blow. Remember that, of course, the scales can all change. The scales, in other words, the range of currents, the range of potentials, and the shape of the curve will look a little bit different depending on those scales, depending on the quantity of material that's present. I might get a huge peak, okay? And if I get a huge peak, it may bury some of those features or make some of those features not visible. But I've stretched this and blown this up for you so that you can see every detail in the cyclic voltammogram. We'll talk about some of the quantitative parameters here in just a minute. Oh, okay. So I've got all of this written out in words for you, and of course you have those slides in your hands. Come on. Okay. Let's talk about some quantitative things. What's going on in here? What's the quantitative analysis of all these different parameters? Here's my same little cyclic voltammogram. I just took the same thing, shrunk it down, stuck it on this slide, okay? And I labeled a couple of things. I didn't label much. I do have my potential going in a cathodic direction, potential going in an anodic direction, cathodic current, anodic current, and then I have, I didn't mark the EP here, okay? This would be cathodic. This would be EP anodic. And then I've got I. Let's make it a capital I. P anodic. I P cathodic. Okay, so those are all parameters that we've talked about. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of diagnostic. This table gives you some diagnostic criteria. The bottom line is this. Cyclic voltammetry is a very important and powerful tool for determining the electrochemical characteristics of a system. When an organic chemist makes some new compound and they're interested in its electrochemistry, they would do cyclic voltammetry because that's going to define everything that's going on in there. It's going to tell them something about how reversible the system is, what the potentials are, various important parameters that they might be concerned with. Something about the kinetics, reversible versus irreversible, all that stuff is going to be determined by this cyclic voltammetry experiment. if I want to just do, now I'm sort of getting away from analytical chemistry, because the analytical chemists don't use cyclic voltammetry very much. It's more of a qualitative tool for studying the behavior of a system, the behavior of a molecule in solution. So the organic chemists, the physical chemists, the people who want to study these systems would use cyclic voltammetry. The analytical chemist is busy just measuring peak heights and determining the quantity of material. But he might have to do, the analytical chemist may have to do a cyclic voltammogram first. Someone brings him a compound. The organic chemist says, look, I do organic chemistry. I don't mess with electrochemistry. Oh, I'm gonna synthesize the compound and bring it to my friend, the analytical chemist, and get them to study it. They'll do the electrochemistry because I can't remember anodic from cathodic and potentials from currents, and I don't know what's going on. So I do my organic chemistry. I make the compound. I bring it to my friend, the analytical chemist. They put it in solution, and they begin to do a cyclic voltammogram so that they can determine what the potential is that the material is going to reduce or oxidize at, what the kinetics of the system might be, whether there's any complicated reactions going on in the system, and parameters such as that, okay, E1/2 values, peak current values, all that kind of stuff. So what I've got here is a little table of diagnostic criterion. And I'm only giving you some. There's many more, but these are some of the key ones. If I were to do my experiment shown here, I could then measure certain parameters. For example, I can measure the peak current, and I could measure if the peak current changes with the scan rate. Remember, nu, that's nu, right? Remember, in my equation I showed you before for voltammetry, nu, I, the current, was related to a whole bunch of complicated, really hairy-looking 3/2 power, you know, stuff. And at the very end of the equation was nu, the scan rate. So I can do my experiment. I make up one solution. Okay, I set up my electrochemical cell. I put my electrodes in there and get it all set up. And then I leave it there and I do several electrochemical experiments. One of them is I scan and I measure the peak current, IP, okay, versus the scan rate. So I scan a few times. And I change the scan rate and I see if there's any change in the current as I change the scan rate. Okay? If it's a reversible charge transfer, reversible, what does that mean? It means that it's a well-behaved system, has fast kinetics that are not dramatically influenced by how fast I'm scanning. The kinetics are so fast that if I scan at 100 millivolts a minute, you know, it doesn't matter. The reaction occurs much faster than that. The reaction occurs at the millisecond, microsecond time frame, and so my scanning along in minutes doesn't change anything. So it says here that parameter, that is the ratio of IP, the peak current, to the scan rate, turns out to be constant no matter I increase the scan rate, increase the scan rate, increase the scan rate. Now I see different currents because current is a function of scan rate, but it follows a constant value. Okay, it follows a constant value. In other words, the system is not slow and therefore unable to keep up with the scan rate. Now, if it's an irreversible system, it's not well behaved. The kinetics are slow and it's not constant with scan rate. So I'm saying that as I increase the scan rate, the electrons can't transfer fast enough to keep up with that scan rate. And so they're lagging the peak current, the rise of that peak current, the peak current going up here to get to this value, is not keeping up with the rate at which I'm scanning. And so each successive, as I increment the scan rate faster, faster, and faster, my peak current gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But according to the equation, it should be getting larger. Okay, the equation, if you go back a few slides, we had that equation. So this is a diagnostic criterion. It tells me, first thing I do is I plug it in there, and I change the scan rate, and I tell my buddy, the organic chemist, well, as far as electrochemistry is concerned, this is an irreversible system because it's not keeping up with the increased scan rate that I'm applying to the system. So that's a diagnostic criterion. If it's really irreversible, I get nothing. I just get no current. If it's slightly irreversible, I get some current, but it doesn't. If I go fast, it doesn't keep up. So this is something I tell my buddy. I said, when it comes to doing electrochemistry, we're going to have to keep it in a slow scan mode. We're going to have to use techniques that have time frames such that the kinetics of the system can keep up with this. And he's making notes and saying, okay, yeah, this is good. All right, and you know, save me that cyclic voltammogram. We'll publish that when we publish this in JAX, you know, Journal of the American Chemical Society. Okay, so then they do another diagnostic criterion. They compare the currents, this value and this value, right? This value comes off of this. This value comes off of here. Okay, they compare the current in the anodic direction down below here and the current in the cathodic direction, and they do a ratio of those two things. If I can do my electrochemistry sufficiently fast, okay, and everything's able to keep up in the system, then the two currents can give me a ratio of one. In other words, pretty much everything I reduce in my forward scan, I reduce in this direction. Okay, when I'm done and go backward, I oxidize it in the reverse scan. Therefore, I get the same amount of current in both scans. First, it's a reduction reaction. Then it's an oxidation reaction. I get the same amount of current in both cases because I'm able to go fast enough. The system's keeping up with my scan rate. The kinetics are keeping up with my scan rate. The material that's produced doesn't diffuse too far away. It's still in the few microns layers around my electrode surface. So when I reverse the scan and go backward, it gets oxidized again. It's right there, ready to be oxidized and react. Now, if I don't see that, if I were to, for example, see a curve that I get a nice forward peak, okay, and then in the reverse scan, I get a small peak. Okay. That is telling me that, of course, the ratio of the two currents is less than one, and that's telling me I've got an irreversible system that's just not keeping up. Okay, it's not keeping up with what's going on. So this is, again, a diagnostic criterion. The third one here, and third and final one I'm going to talk about, is the distance, the delta EP, the distance between the peaks. Okay, so we got peak current for the reduction reaction, peak current for the oxidation reaction. If I plot this whole thing out, I say, okay, there's a delta between them, a difference between them. And we said, you know, Nernst is applying here, and there's supposed to be some difference between them. And if that distance is constant, well, you know, Nernst doesn't care about scan rate. Nernst was a thermodynamic kind of guy, I guess. Kinetics and, so he was a free energy kind of guy. So it's like free energy versus kinetics, right? Free energy just says if I've got the proper potentials, okay, Nernst being a free energy kind of a guy, in other words, E is related to delta G. So he says if I have the sufficient potential, then I should be reducing the species of interest. And according to my equation, he forgot about kinetics. Okay, he forgot about that there's an actual rate of that reaction. So if everything's reversible and kinetics are not important, and the kinetics are so fast that there's no issue with kinetics, then Nernst applies, and what we end up with is the average. Okay, you take the distance between the peak potentials and you divide by two, is constant with scan rate. The peaks come out in exactly the same place no matter how fast you scan. If the kinetics are okay and it's all just a thermodynamic process that E is related to delta G and all I need is that amount of energy and I get the reaction to occur. then the delta EP, the difference between those two peaks, the forward peak and the reverse peak, stays exactly the same. Does not change. It is constant with the scan rate. However, if it's an irreversible system and I throw kinetics into the mix, even in the forward scan, if I'm scanning really fast, it's lagging. And it may not reach its full maximum potential, excuse me, current, until some potential later than it should. It's a lag process. It's not keeping up. The kinetics are not keeping up. Then, likewise, that was ugly. And usually the current would be smaller. Okay. And then, in the reverse reaction, likewise, the same thing would occur. Okay. And what I end up is getting larger and larger delta between the two peaks, because they're just not able to keep up with the scan rate. I increase the scan rate more, they get further apart. Okay, so there's that problem. Again, diagnostic criteria. So cyclic voltammetry, again, all I did was put one sample into my electrochemical cell, and I just sat there and played with the buttons. You know, faster scan rate, slower scan rate. Okay, measure the peak current, measure the peak potential, measure these different diagnostic parameters, determine some things about the system. Now, there's other things. These are just reversible, irreversible diagnostic criterion. Okay, the difference between a well-behaved and a not well-behaved system. We also, of course, are finding out what the peak potentials are. Okay, and we are finding out what the behavior of the system is. Now, I'll probably have this later on, so I better not jump ahead. Here's a good one. So again, this is something I stole from the internet. This is somebody's data. Okay, so they've got a system, potential versus current. And they're scanning along, and look, there's a little something there. And then they get a beautiful looking peak. It's almost very symmetrical looking. Right? Then they reverse the scan, and they get this little behavior. It drops down, and then it begins to do the anodic peak. All right, and then we get something going on here. A couple of things about this real-life cyclic voltammogram. This peak, it looks bigger than this peak. Right? Well, we talked about that. So there's a little bit of irreversibility here. Right? We mentioned that previously. Secondly, there is this thing going on. Don't know what that is. And then there's another peak that shows up over here. Okay, now, the way I've labeled this is... again, I'm not sure what this peak is, but again, if I were to look at this cyclic voltammogram, I would say, okay, ox is clearly going to red in the forward scan, and we're going to say that's what this is. In the reverse scan, ox is being produced again. Red is going to ox, okay, in the reverse scan. All right, those are clear. That's basic. Right? Then I see something else, and it may be that red... the reduced species, which there's no in this region of the curve, there's no red, there's no reduced species. We get to over here, and we begin to produce red. We begin to produce the reduced species. If that reduced species undergoes some kind of reaction, maybe it spontaneously converts to A. Okay, so that's what I've said here. You form red, and it degrades. It falls apart under its own. Maybe it forms a dimer. Maybe it forms a polymer. Maybe it does some kind of chemistry, whatever it is. Then, in the reverse scan, I have a new species, A, which may undergo electrochemistry at some potential. And that may be what occurs in giving me this additional peak. Now, this is another major criterion or characterization ability of cyclic voltammetry. I can do this experiment and tell something about the chemistry of the system. Oxidation, reduction, what happens to the reduced form? Something's happening to it. It's undergoing some kind of a reaction, and I can see that in my cyclic voltammogram. All right, so this is, again, something that we might want to do in order to study this process. Okay. In the past, I have usually had little or no success at going to the internet. So let's see, what was I going to do? I was going to press this button, not that button. Press this button. The same thing will occur. If you go to this website, okay, you will find a chapter on cyclic voltammetry, and it's it'll give you another explanation of the concepts or processes that are going on. Hey, look, it came up. A cyclic voltammetry primer, okay, and it tells you a little bit about it. Tells you its relationship to linear sweep voltammetry, and oh, look, it's got a pretty background. Oh, there's the applied waveforms, and there's a cyclic voltammogram, and you can look at this a little bit and say, gee, I didn't understand what he was saying. Maybe it would be nice if I went to this other place and got another description of what's going on. Okay, can't believe it worked. All right, let me give you a brief review, and then we are approaching. Some of you who came in late, you probably didn't come in late, but maybe you did come in late. If you came in any minute, any more than a second after 8 o'clock, you missed the part where I told when the exam was, and I gave out all the answers to the exam. Okay, so that's what you get for being late. So, but anyway, we are going to have an exam, and it's going to come up in about 2 weeks, and I'm thinking about the 17th or the 19th or whatever you would like. Get a little consensus. Maybe we can determine that. I tried to fix the website, and then I realized I put one of the classes on Saturday. I got to go fix that after class this morning. But here we have a brief review. This is not what I wanted. I wanted a pen. Okay. We started with potentiometry. Okay. These are electroanalytical techniques that we've been talking about. We then moved into some basic techniques using an electrolytic cell, so potentiometry, galvanic cell. Then we talked about controlled potential electrolysis, which uses an electrolytic cell. We took a baby step forward and did chronoamperometry. Then I mentioned chronopotentiometry, which was a constant current type system. Then I mentioned coulometry, which could be done constant current or not constant current, either one. And I related the controlled potential electrolysis, the chronoamperometry, and the coulometry as basically the same experiment but measuring different things. Then we talked about voltammetry, stirred and unstirred, and cyclic voltammetry. I kind of left that out, cyclic. All right. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, depending on how you count them. We're racking them up here, okay? We're racking up our different electrochemical techniques. I'm not trying to make electrochemists out of you. I'm trying to make you understand the breadth of analytical chemistry, that there are a lot of permutations or variations on this experiment, just like there is on NMR. Anybody do NMR? Okay, nobody like. Okay, a couple of NMR people. So you go down in these days, you know, you can do all sorts of multi-dimensional NMR and, you know, cozy, nosy, rosy, posy, I don't know, all these different techniques, all sorts of different NMR experiments, okay? Well, it's the same thing kind of here with electrochemistry. It's the same basic setup. We understand it. We figure out how it works. And then we can apply different waveforms, different potential waveforms, and we can do different types of experiments and get different types of information. New and improved electrochemistry, I guess. And so we're moving on, and we'll talk about a few more techniques. DC polarography is the next one. I mentioned a guy named Hayarovsky, Czechoslovakian person, who I guess he invented polarography, although a lot of times it's not the guy who invented it that gets all the credit, because Hayarovsky did all the work. Okay, somebody else might have come up with it and said, hey, maybe you could do this, and he ran into the lab and did it, and then spent most of his life studying it and developing it and demonstrating to the world all of the great features of DC polarography. So, what is DC polarography? Well, DC just stands for direct current. So, in direct current, all that means is we're going to apply a waveform like this. Okay, we've seen it before. It's the same waveform that we apply in linear sweep voltammetry and the cyclic voltammetry and all the techniques that involve a potential scan. We start out with the simplest waveform, this straight line, okay, this ramp, in changing the potential constantly, okay, with time. Now, polarography is the same as voltammetry, it says here. Same as voltammetry in unstirred solution. Because we're applying the same waveform, and we're going to measure current I versus potential E. Okay, so we're going to measure the same thing. Well, if it's the same thing, then why does it have a different name? It has a different name because it uses the dropping mercury electrode, and that makes a huge difference. Okay, that makes a huge difference in the result that you get when you do the experiment. Okay, when you do the experiment, you're doing the same thing. It's the same electrochemical cell. It's the same reference electrode. It's the same counter electrode. It's the same solution, the same electrolyte, the same potentiostat. Okay, everything's the same, except I'm now going to use this beast known as the dropping mercury electrode, and that is going to change some things in the system, resulting in a different output waveform, a different resulting data or signal that comes from the system. So, same as voltammetry in unstirred solution, we vary the potential linearly with time. We measure current versus time. I said that. Current. Sometimes I write it capital I. Sometimes I write it small I, right? So we're going to measure current versus time. We're actually going to plot it as current versus potential. And then oxygen red or soluble. Red dissolves in the mercury. Okay, it doesn't have to, but in the experiment that I'm going to show you, that is one case. It could just get reduced at the surface and diffuse away. That's okay too, but in the case that I'm going to talk about, it's going to dissolve in the mercury. It's going to be a metal that amalgamates, that dissolves into the mercury. We've talked a little bit about that before. Reversible reaction. Okay. Boy, that's an ugly looking diagram. Okay, this is a diagram I took out of some textbook that shows a dropping mercury electrode. Here's my electrochemical cell, same as what I might use for anything. It's got my electrode here, my counter electrode. This piece of capillary tubing coming in is my dropping mercury, and there's a little drop of mercury at the bottom falling off. I might have a reference electrode, calomel reference electrode, so that's this thingy. So I've got my three electrodes, reference, working, counter electrode. Solution's in there. Okay. If mercury's dropping off the bottom, then there's a pool of mercury in the bottom. I've got two tubes coming in to de-aerate the system. I'm pumping in nitrogen, typically. If I'm rich, I use argon. It's more expensive than nitrogen. I could use helium also. Right? Any one of these things will work. They're just inert gases. And is one better than the other? Well, you know, some people like helium because helium doesn't dissolve very much in liquids, and therefore you don't get a lot of bubbles in the solution. People use it in LC to purge out gases. If I use nitrogen, I just displace all the oxygen and other gases with nitrogen. And the nitrogen may degas and create bubbles. But it's all the same. All I need is some inert gas because I want to get rid of oxygen. Oxygen will cause a signal in polarography and in most voltammetry. And therefore, if I get rid of it, I don't have to worry about it. Okay, so I purge away. Now, why is there two tubes? Well, before I start the experiment, I may want to bubble. These are bubbles. Okay, in case you want to know what those were, those are bubbles. I bubble nitrogen through the whole system, and I purge out all of the other gases that are there. But I can't, this is voltammetry unstirred. I can't keep bubbling or I'm stirring with my bubbles. So I shut off the bubbles, okay, and I have nitrogen coming out this tube, which blankets the surface with nitrogen. And I shut off the bubbles. No bubbles, blanket. Okay. So during my experiment, I'm blanketing the surface of the solution with nitrogen so that oxygen doesn't come into the cell and dissolve into the water, whatever my solvent is, and create a problem for me. So I usually have two tubes or some mechanism by which I can purge the whole system and then blanket the system. Okay, so that's what that's all about. So now we've described everything in the electrochemical cell. This little dashed area over here is my potentiostat, three electrode system, as we described before. Okay, a voltmeter of some sort, a potentiometer to measure the potential of the working electrode versus the reference, so working reference. And then the power supply that provides the juice and the ammeter part of it that measures the current. Okay, so all that stuff we saw before. And then up here is the mercury reservoir. I might have a tube over here, a glass bulb connected with tubing, that might have a few pounds of mercury in it, maybe a couple pounds of mercury. Okay, and connect that with some tubing to a piece of glass, what is often referred to as barometer. It says here, marine barometer tubing. What's marine barometer tubing? It's like a capillary. It's a very thin opening that goes through there. You know how a barometer works, right? You got a barometer, atmospheric pressure changes, the mercury changes, the height of the mercury changes, and you can tell the atmospheric pressure in millimeters of mercury. Well, Hierofsky needed a thin piece of glass tubing, so he used barometer tubing. It's not as small as a capillary. A real capillary is really tiny. You know, you draw out a piece of glass, heat it up in a flame, and draw it out. You get a really thin opening. This is a little bit larger than that. I might even have a slide that tells you the diameter of the opening. So the point of all this is, if I'm going to have a supply of mercury that's going to dribble out the end here and give me drops of mercury falling off the end of the tubing, I have to keep the height of the reservoir of mercury about the same. If I change the height, I'm going to get a higher head pressure, a hydrostatic pressure, and I'm going to get faster flow of mercury. If I lower the mercury reservoir, I get slower flow of mercury. So Hierofsky wanted to be able to adjust that. Hey, look, dropping mercury electrode. He wanted to be able to adjust that so that he could change the rate of the flow and keep it constant. You get to see my animated this movie. You could just watch this thing all day. Okay, this is a pretty crude diagram that I got off the internet. But so there's the reservoir up top, right? The reservoir of mercury is right up here, and the tubing going in. And then what's happening at the end of the capillary? Drops of mercury are coming off. And there's my potentiostat, pretty crude looking. My reference electrode is over here. And so that's the basic system. Let me go back. Okay, so he's got a barometer tubing there. He keeps the mercury at a certain number of millimeters. And if he keeps that head pressure, we always get a constant flow of mercury. Slow flow of mercury through tubing, drop forms, expands, falls off, a new drop forms. This is a DME, dropping mercury electrode, and it's realistic, okay? This is the real deal. When I came here too long ago, the guy before me was an electrochemist, a guy in my lab, and he had one of these set up. And it's a beast. You got to put it in a big tray, because what happens if you start spilling mercury? You don't want mercury all over the floor. Mercury is a neurotoxin. You become mad as a hatter. You become crazy. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm perfectly normal. Okay. But mercury vapors are toxic, and historically, people who made hats used mercury and became mad, and then Alice in Wonderland and the Mad Hatter. Anyway, you got to be careful with mercury. Nobody wants to deal with this beast anymore. So, what do? They use a beast like this. Okay, they use a modern version of a dropping mercury electrode. So, up here, these are two different companies who make these. But there's a big pool of mercury up here. We have several of these, and the mercury comes down through a solenoid device and comes into the capillary and into the electrochemical cell, and you can control the size of the drop. You have a little switch, large, medium, small. And you can, how fast it comes out. Once a second, once every half second, once every 5 seconds. Okay? And it just controls the flow. And the same thing here. Static mercury drop electrode, EG&G, Princeton Applied Research, these companies, analytical chemistry companies are bought and sold all the time because they make money. And so they change their names a lot. So it used to be EG&G, Princeton Applied Research. I don't know what it's called now. Controlled growth electrode is made by Bioanalytical Systems. That's privately owned, I believe, by a man named Peter Kissinger out in Indiana. But EG&G is publicly traded, I believe. Anyway, in case you want to run out and buy some stock. Okay, we saw that diagram already. Advantages of a dropping mercury electrode, the DME. Well, a new electrode surface forms every few seconds. So, you know, you got this new electrode surface. And we said some things before about mercury. If I get a new electrode surface every few seconds, I don't have to worry about impurities building up on the surface. We got a liquid, clean. Okay, I get some clean mercury. Did I tell you how you distill mercury, right? You make people. It's a lost art. When I was in graduate school, we distilled mercury. Okay, we set up a vacuum distillation system for mercury. Vacuum distillation for solvents you're probably familiar with, but for mercury, it's probably an unusual situation. And we would triple distill the mercury, distill it, collect it. Pour it back in the still, distill it again, to get rid of the impurities. Nowadays, you can take that and send it off to Bethlehem Apparatus Company in Pennsylvania, and they'll take your mercury and give you clean, triple-distilled mercury in place of it. Okay, so we got a new electrode. Metallic products dissolve or amalgamate with mercury. You know what an amalgam is? An amalgam is just a mixture or an alloy of mercury with some metal. If you take like gold, yellow gold, and you dip it in liquid mercury, it becomes amalgamated, or the gold will not be yellow anymore, it will have mercury on it. And it forms a mixture. In people's teeth, a lot of times, they have either gold amalgams or silver amalgams, right? And the dentist, nowadays it's made of epoxy. Okay, now if you go to the dentist and you have to have a cavity filled, get epoxy. Putting mercury in your mouth is not a good idea. But they take silver and mercury and they mix them together and then they jam it in that cavity, that hole that's in your tooth, and make a surface that lasts for a long time. Might last 40, 50 years. So it's good. That epoxy, it won't last that long. But it probably won't kill you. Maybe it will. I don't know. Okay, so it forms an amalgam. So as the drop of mercury is there and I apply a potential to it, things are reducing at the surface of the electrode. If it's a metal, like copper going from copper ion to copper metal, that copper metal will dissolve into the mercury, dissolve right into it. Remember the high hydrogen overvoltage? It allows more negative potentials to be achieved with a mercury electrode, so that's a good thing. Expansion of the drop area decreases the diffusion-limited current expansion of drop area and decreases in diffusion-limited current counteract each other. Okay, so I'll explain that in more detail. Actually, I'll explain that in excruciating detail in just a minute. So those were advantages, okay? Some big advantages. New clean electrode, surface for electrochemistry, high hydrogen over voltage, and then there's this thing with counteracting the current change, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. There are some disadvantages. Mercury is easily oxidized, so you can't go to very positive potentials because you get a huge mercury oxidation wave. Okay, so that's a problem. Mercury is the DME is cumbersome to set up. You got this. You got to have a big tray to collect catch any spilled mercury. You got to have all this tubing and glass, and you got to be raising and lowering this reservoir, and it's just a huge beast. It's a problem. It's very fragile. If you break something, mercury is everywhere. Okay, mercury is very toxic. You could end up dead. You know, that's a problem. Okay, if you're going to use the dropping mercury a lot, it could be costly, dropping mercury and then having to send it out to the Bethlehem apparatus or set up. We had a whole lab, small lab, maybe about one-third the size of this room, where we set up our mercury still. Nobody wanted to spend too much time in there. And we did our purification of mercury in there, but that's because we were doing a lot of electrochemistry. So you can't always devote that kind of space. You got to buy it. It becomes costly. That's a problem. It has to be high purity mercury, or should be high purity mercury if you want to get good electrochemistry. And then it says mercury can air oxidize, and then, oh yeah, so you get like a, if you leave mercury laying around, which you shouldn't do, you get a sort of a black film on the surface. It's mercury oxide. And that film clogs up the capillary that you're trying to use for your electrochemistry. So it can be a problem. All right, so these are all disadvantages of the dropping mercury electrode. I showed you those pictures. All right, here's this whole business about an advantage of the growth of the drop counteracting the Cottrell reduction in current. All right, so we know the first part of this already. We've already talked about this part of it. That is, whenever I'm doing voltammetry in an unstirred system, I have an electrode surface, and material is reducing or whatever at the surface. Maybe it's oxidizing, reducing, whatever. And I deplete the solution, and the current drops off. So we have Cottrell equation behavior like this, and we have the Cottrell equation for us. Right? So this is what we expect if we're doing voltammetry in a diffusion-controlled system. Now, in the case of mercury, in the case of a dropping mercury electrode, DME, the area of the electrode, remember area has been in all of our equations? The area is increasing. As I do the experiment, the little drop is growing, and then it falls off. And then a new drop comes out, and it's growing, and it falls off. That drop growth area counteracts the decrease that you see with the Cottrell equation. It's strictly a geometry thing. Maybe this is a good exam question. Derive this equation. It's not a good exam question. I won't ask that. Okay. But there's some complex geometry here that says this little drop of mercury is expanding, so its area is getting bigger and bigger, and we know that area is one of the parameters. Oh, look, it's even here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this and plug it in here. All right, I'm going to plug this geometry equation that tells me about drop growth, the area increasing like this. Okay, I'm going to plug that into the Cottrell equation, and what do I get? A mess. Oh, this tells you what everything is. I get this equation. Well, I get these two equations. A guy named Ilkovic figured this out. I get two equations, all right? It's basically the same equation. The only difference between these two equations is the constant. I'll explain that in just a minute. The two effects, concentration polarization, Cottrell equation, decreases current, and the area increase, which increases the current, they cancel each other out. You combine them, you get the Ilkovic equation. Let me just say that what the parameters are. So area we defined, Okay, rho here, rho sub hg, is the density of the mercury. So mercury has some density. Obviously, it's quite dense. And so that's important. There's a mass flow rate here. What's a mass flow rate? We normally think of milliliters per minute, volume flow rates. This is a mass flow rate. It's grams per second or grams per minute or something like that. Why do you do that? Because it's easy. You take a bunch of drops of mercury and you put them on a balance and you weigh it. You say, okay, 10 seconds, I'll weigh it. All right, I've got a mass flow rate of such and such an amount. So the flow rate of mercury is important. The drop time, how many drops are we getting per second? All right. And all this together, and what do we get? We got some constant here. Pi is in here, okay. We plug that in here, and we get our Ilkovich equation. All right. Let's see. What else can I tell you? You get a really ugly output wave. All right. Polarography gives you a wave, first of all, and it's a hairy wave. Okay, just call me Harry. All right, it's got all these lines on it. What's that all about? Okay, well, I'll tell you what it's about. It's about the fact that when the drop is large, you're going to get a large current. When the drop is small, you're going to get a small current. And the drop is changing in size across the time frame. So you're gonna see drop growth and fall off in your output wave. So polarography is voltammetry in an unstirred solution. But before we got a wave for a stirred solution and a peak for an unstirred solution. That gets reversed in voltammetry. In polarography, and we end up. So this is a polarogram, and we end up with a wave, even though it's unstirred. And we get a wave that has this hairy drop-induced thing on the surface. The two equations that I showed you a minute ago, one of them is for the top of the wave, max current, and one of them is for the average current. Okay, so if I were to look at this plot, max current, average current. Okay, so I've got those two things labeled there for you. So you just use a different equation. The equations are exactly the same. They have a different constant in there. We have diffusion. We have what's referred to as a limiting current. Here we call it a diffusion current. Just different names. Hierovsky had his own system. Okay. So rather than be I sub L, and it is the limiting current, it's still the same thing. We just call it diffusion current. E1/2 is the same. I told you before the capacitive current. It can also be called the residual current. What's the difference? Residual current is defined as capacitive current, background current, or baseline current caused by capacitive effects and impurities in the system. It's the same thing. Okay, it's just a sloping line down at the baseline. All right? That's what polarography looks like. That's what the polarogram looks like. Here's another one. This is for cadmium in HCl. You go along, you get a nice wave, you start to see the fluctuations due to the drop. We got max current, we got average current. This is 5 × 10⁻⁴ molar cadmium. That's not very low, so we got a really stand up straight looking wave because the sensitivity of the system is low. Half wave potential is shown here, diffusion current. If you had no cadmium in the system, you would get a wave like this. Okay, and ultimately you would what happens over here? Hydrogen reduction. You keep going to reducing currents, you end up reducing over here. H plus goes to H2. Okay, we saw that previously. So we have an available range goes all the way to negative 1.2 volts. Zero over here we get mercury oxidation. And so we got a range in here. We can do lots of metals. Cadmium is one of the metals. It falls right in the middle. It's very well behaved. Amalgamates with the mercury. Everything is fine. Okay. So this is polarography, and I guess I'll quit because I probably wore you out. but we'll talk about a few other issues next class related to, is it 9:20? Is that right? My eyesight's going. 9:20, yep, okay. We'll finish up on that next class. We'll talk about polarography, finish up on polarography, and move on. And we'll talk about, we'll nail down when we're going to have this exam. 3, 6, 9. Only one person is missing. And I got all your homeworks, maybe except one, but one or two. And I'll take a look at that as soon as I get a chance. Okay?